Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the latest installment of Unspun. Today I'm joined by Lennon Honor, and we're here to discuss his new film, new documentary, Beyond Gangster Blackface. And before I get started here with Lennon, I want to give thanks to those who donated to the show this week, including six-year-old Kane. He's showing a lot of you up, and I appreciate the note here that Kane wrote, so I'm going to read that very quickly. And Kane writes, "Dear Jan, I'm learning a lot of stuff from you. My mom and I started watching your radio series with Hans. Here is your donation for this month. Love, Kane." And Kane, good job doing your homework and writing this out. I know it probably pains you to do so, but good job, buddy. And so anyway, Lennon, you know, for the last, I suppose, what's it been, probably a little over 2 years, beginning with a series with Dr. Hans Utter, we did a whole breakdown of music, mind control, and psychobiology, and we've kind of gone from there. We went into the punk rock music, we went into, you know, the Grateful Dead, we went into trance music and Burning Man, and we've touched on rap music. We still haven't done country music yet. That's going to have to be done too. But today I'm glad to have you on. We're here to discuss hip hop and gangster rap. I appreciate your work. I watched your documentary almost twice all the way through. Tried to take some notes, which I can't find now. So hopefully hopefully I don't forget everything I watched twice. So it's hopefully in my head. So anyway, Lincoln, welcome back to the show. It's been a couple of years since you've been here. Good to have you back.
Oh, thank you, Jan. And it's been a while, but I want to thank you for having me back. And I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you and to share some of my research as well as the document.
Well, yeah. And so what you really focus on, and you start off the documentary, which I was kind of surprised by, in Los Angeles, about Los Angeles. And, you know, of course, you grew up in San Diego. I grew up in the L.A. Basin, about an hour outside of L.A. And so, you know, it never occurred to me that a lot of this stuff, you know, in hindsight, it makes sense. But a lot of this stuff coming out of L.A., you think, you know, maybe New York, a lot of this stuff. But, of course, L.A. is going to be a big center of this type of music scene. So, you know, why start off with L.A. and what got you into this line of inquiry to begin with?
Yeah, so the documentary is a critical analysis of gangster rap and with the focus on N.W.A. So that in and of itself was a good reason to start off in L.A. because N.W.A. is a Compton-based rap group and have a very huge following, at least then and even to this day, to a degree, in Los Angeles. But also it was important to kind of start off talking about Los Angeles simply because Los Angeles has long been a hub for the entertainment industry, global entertainment industry, not just in the United States of America, but globally. The influence that Hollywood films have had on the global community has been quite profound. The influence that the music genres that have come out of Los Angeles, different music groups have had, and in particular, N.W.A. with the advent of gangster rap and the proliferation of gangster rap, it was important to start with Los Angeles, but also because there were also musical or musicians, in particular jazz musicians, who I wanted to at least give a little bit of credit to. Jazz being a very important musical genre coming from the African-American tradition. And so it was important to actually give some props to some jazz musicians inside of the film as well. So that's kind of like why I wanted to start in Los Angeles, because of the huge musical influence that the Los Angeles music scene has had globally. And it kind of set the platform or the foundation for the actual documentary once we began to talk about N.W.A.
All right. So, you know, and I don't want to give too much away for the audience. What did you find in looking into N.W.A.? And of course, for those who don't know, N.W.A. is Niggas with Attitude. So, you know, for those who aren't up on the colloquial slang or however you want to put that, you know,
Yes, and so NWA stands for Niggas with Attitudes, which was at the time very controversial. The name itself was very controversial. These days, not as much, but at that time, extremely controversial. I wanted to say, too, because you had asked, like, why did I decide to get into an inquiry and an analysis of NWA? And part of the reason why was because about 2 years ago, I heard that NWA, they were coming out with a film, a Hollywood film. They call it a film biopic. It's supposed to be the way that they phrase it, or the way that they kind of promote it, was like this was a historical piece that was going to give an accurate depiction of NWA, their influence, their social influence, what their ultimate objective was. And what I found to be very troubling about that was because when I thought back to NWA when I was growing up listening to NWA, I didn't see them as necessarily a positive force per se. In fact, I remember that their lyrics were very, very much degrading, especially towards women, very disrespectful towards women, but also the promotion of gang culture. I remember that being a central theme in their lyrics. So when I heard that there was going to be a film coming out, that was troubling to me because I figured out of all of the hip hop groups for a film of this magnitude to be produced for, why NWA? And what I thought about was that it's the next generation. Propaganda being produced for the next generation about NWA to encourage the next generation of youth to go ahead and go back and listen to NWA's music and then therefore be influenced or mind controlled by those lyrics, just as my generation was influenced. So that's why I decided to do this documentary. And ultimately what I did was I went through a critical analysis. I did 6 months of research up front, studying, researching, reading books, watching a lot of interviews online of different artists. But I also began to do a critical analysis of NWA's lyrics, and I went through all of their music. I went through each track on each album, and I calculated what were the words that were being used the most for each song. Then I went for each album, calculated all those words for each album, and then based upon those words, formulate what were the major themes that were presented in NWA's lyrics.
Let me ask you a question. Why focus on NWA specifically rather than other hip-hop rap groups, gangster rap groups in the area at the time as well?
Yeah, well, there's two reasons. One was because NWA, they were coming out with their own film. And I felt like there should have been a counterbalancing force, because the narrative that was spun in the film after I saw the film was to promote NWA as a socially conscious rap group, which in point of fact, they were not a socially conscious rap group at all. One only has to do the critical analysis of their lyrics. But the other reason why is because gangster rap was proliferated through NWA. And so when people think about gangster rap, what they automatically think of first is NWA. There were people who came before NWA who actually had gangster rap material. As an example, Schoolie D. Another example would be KRS-One. His first album was titled Criminal Minded. That was a gangster rap album. Another person, of course, would be Ice-T. So we can look at Ice-T, we can look at Schoolie D, and we can look at KRS-One when he was with Boogie Down Productions, and we can say that that's gangster rap. But once you bring in NWA into the mix, in terms of the influence, those other three hip hop artists, they do not compare. In point of fact, no other gangster rap group has ever compared to the level of influence, global influence that NWA had and continues to have to this day. In point of fact, that's probably why the film was so successful. The film biopic that came out was because, in point of fact, their global reach not only extended to the time period when they were active, but also all the way until today.
Now, looking back, I'm not sure if you saw my show a couple of weeks ago with Mark Devlin from the UK, but we were discussing a lot of the underground or, you know, sort of the hidden scandal around KRS-One and African Bambaataa. Mm-hmm. Is that anything that you've looked at all?
Yes, I looked into it a lot. In point of fact, when the scandal, and see, here's the thing with African Bambaataa, that has been circulating for a long time, decades in point of fact. It's just no one really came out, and because of we're in the era of social media, when people do come out and speak out, it actually gains more traction, but it's not like these allegations weren't present 10, 20, 30 years ago. Well, 10, 20 years ago. So yes, I did in point of fact look into that. And then KRS's comments, I was not surprised by his comments either, even though a lot of people would assume that he wouldn't be in support of someone like Afrika Bambaataa when he did make those comments in support of him, I wasn't necessarily surprised. Just because someone speaks a good game or raps a good game doesn't mean that that person is a good character or of high moral value.
Absolutely. You know, and let me just interject there. You know, KRS-One, and add my own legal caveats here. This is in my own opinion, et cetera. You know, he's constantly promoted as probably the most stand up, right, teaching a real message in his music and lyrics. And then we see him what appears to be defending a pedophile. It's a bit shocking, to say the least. And we're seeing this kind of stuff happen all over the place since this Pedogate scandal broke last year about this time.
Yeah, that's true. Pedophilia is a major problem globally, but in particular, there has been a lot that has come out in the entertainment industry. And that's, I mean, on some level, we can say we are surprised by someone like KRS-One supporting Afrika Bambaataa. But on the other hand, I'm not surprised. I'm really not. That's the thing. It's again, if you're not of a high moral character, it doesn't really matter what's going on behind the scenes to you, as long as you continue to put forth that persona that somehow you're a morally outstanding person and you become the teacher and somehow you're socially conscious and your rap is conscious. As a 41-year-old male, African-American male, if you want to call me that, I don't find any of his music necessarily be intellectually gifted, per se. However, for young boys who were growing up during that time period, it may have appeared that way.
I can see that. All right, so let's get back into your documentary film. So, you know, you break down a lot of, you crunch a lot of numbers, you go through NWA's four albums, you count all of the lyrics, all the repetitions, etc. And so what do you find in this album that is so shocking? And stepping back, you know, if now we can look back on this music in 30 years hindsight and see the changes in culture that have happened today. You know, so what have you found, or what did you find in the music?
Yes.
And then from there, I want to go into what you think has been the impact on society since then.
Sure. So what I found was, through critical analysis, and what, again, I kind of gave a brief overview, but I talk about specifically what I do inside the film in terms of my methodology during my critical analysis, not only counting the words per each track, what words are being used the most, but then calculating throughout each album based upon the repetition. Repetition is always key in mind control. The more you repeat something, the more real it becomes in people's minds.
Absolutely.
So therefore, whatever is the main words or the main message that is being repeated over and over again inside of a music album or even in a particular song, that is what is being what is being issued as mind control. That's the major theme. So what I found was, for all four albums, I did words counts and critical analysis for each track, each album, but then for all four albums, their complete discography. And what I found was that the major theme that was presented over 48 tracks with a total runtime of 3 hours, 9 minutes, and 44 seconds was, in point of fact, disrespect of women. And what I found was that there were 553 instances of disrespect towards women over the course of 3 hours, 9 minutes, and 44 seconds. Second place, 385 times, was the use of the word nigger. Third place, 345 times, self-aggrandizement, which ultimately means that a person is kind of presenting themselves to be greater than what they really are, and also disrespecting other people in the process. Fourth place was the word bitch, calling women bitches. That was 208 times. The use of the word fuck, 198 times, so vulgarity being infused, disrespect of men, 193 times, and it goes on and on and on. General violence against men, African-American men in particular, 88 times, drugs, references, 87 times, and I have all this list, there's a whole list, 86 times, alcohol. So what I'm outlining here is that on the surface level, there are people who may believe that NWA was a socially conscious rap group who spoke out against police brutality. But in point of fact, the preeminent theme in their actual lyrics, and again, this is critical analysis, this cannot be denied, anyone can actually go and do the word counts, the preeminent theme in their music and in their lyrics was the disrespect of women. So what type of an impact would this have? Well, I want people to consider something. Most people, when we listen to NWA's albums, it's not like we just listen to one album once or one song once. We will listen to it over and over and over and over again. So if you can imagine, let's say over the course of a year, there may be a child who listens to all four of their albums. Let's say if they listen to it let's say four times.
Let me put it in context for some of the audience, all right? Imagine you're born in 67 or 70, okay? And you're used to hearing classic rock on the radio station. Okay, it's 2017, that's 50 years. Now, how many times have you heard the Eagles Hotel California?
okay. Right.
Right? Mm-hmm. And so multiply that, you know, and then the number of times, 500 and whatever you said, you know, multiply that over your lifetime. I mean, I can't even stand classic rock anymore. You know, it's so obvious. It's such obvious mind control. You know, sex, drugs, rock and roll. Sex, drugs, rock and roll. Ad infinitum. You know, it's just like, okay, give me a break. So, you know, this is what I'm trying to get people to see in their minds. It's not just the fact that they put it in the album. It's the fact that a child or a young adult who picks that tape album back then, probably a cassette tape up off the shelf, and puts it in their cassette player, and they're driving around in their car gangbanging or whatever, thinking they're cool, repeating it over and over and over.
Mm-hmm. It's the repetition. It's the cumulative effect over time. And that's the thing. Everything has some effect. And the more that you're exposed to something, the more of an effect or impact it's going to have on you.
Right.
So you can imagine, again, if someone listened to all four NWA's albums over the course of a year, and they listened to each album four times, they would have heard The Disrespect of Women over 2,000 times, 2,200 times, and actually, to be very specific, 232 times.
Did you try to find any information how often a child back in the 80s would have played NWA's music in a year?
No. What we did outline was that nowadays, most children on average listen to about 40 hours of music per week. And oftentimes and it sounds incredible, but the truth is that oftentimes them hearing the music is not necessarily conscious. They may be walking by and they hear music in the background, or maybe someone's playing the music, or maybe a car is driving by. Or I don't know if they do this now, but back in the day on the school bus, they would play music, or someone would be playing music. That's a lot of that's a lot to digest. That's like a work week. So we do outline that. I didn't find any statistics to outline how much, on average, a child who was, you know, in 1987, 1980, 1989, 1990, and around that time, how much music that they were being exposed to. But what I did recall was my own exposure. And we talk about that in some of the interview guests inside the film. They actually talk about their exposure to NWA as well, especially in Southern California. And that was why it was important for me to address Los Angeles, because during that time period, once NWA kind of went mainstream, the influence that they had globally was significant. But the influence that they had in Southern California, especially given the social conditions that many of us were being raised in, was quite profound. Which gets to something that you had asked, too. I want to just mention real quick. You said, well, what type of impact does that have? Well, as an example, if you're listening to women, or if you listen to NWA and they're disrespecting women 553 times over the course of two albums, that's going to impact how you see women. Right. As a young man. In point of fact, as a young girl, it's going to impact how you see yourself. Another example, if they're calling women bitches 208 times, that's going to impact the language that you use as a young man. Over time, the cumulative effect, not automatically. And some people, you know, I can tell you from personal experience, and this is just being honest, Jan, it impacted me, the language. I didn't start calling women bitches until after I got into NWA. That wasn't by accident, but it was also the repetition. Hearing them calling women bitches over and over again, it does impact how it, over time, cumulative effect, repetition, it impacts how we think, how we speak, and ultimately how we behave.
Now, I want to mention here, for a lot of people may not understand, that a popularity of an album, like back in the day, Casey Kasem's Top 40 or something like that, right?
Yeah.
Now, what most people think is that this is organic, you know, the number one album, the number one song on the America's Top 40 or whatever, and it's how many times people requested the song. It's actually quite the opposite. What the radio stations do is they repeat the song over and over and over, and that determines the popularity of the song and the album. Okay,
that's right.
So the audience actually understands it backward. Mm-hmm. So they actually determine in advance what albums they're going to put at the top of the chart, which brings me to my next point that I wanted to get into. How much of this, and I find, I'm going to give a little bit away from my own point of view and from my research with Hans, I find that this is completely engineered. How much of this did you find was targeted social engineering against the black community as well as against the greater community as a whole?
Well, in my research, I read quite a few biographies and autobiographies, and there's information that will illustrate that, yes, once it became known within the entertainment industry, and in particular the music industry, that gangster rap could be a lucrative form of entertainment, that there was a strategic effort to push the whole gang culture phenomenon. This is to say that sometimes social engineering comes out of the financial viability of a particular type of a genre of music. This is not to say that a specific genre of music comes out of an attempt for social engineering, because in point of fact, in my research, it was clear to me that what NWA promoted and produced was out of an organic experience.
It was or it was not?
It was.
Because here's the issue, though, is even the title of your documentary says it, Beyond Gangster Blackface. So clearly, they were putting on a facade that wasn't what they lived.
Yes.
It's intentional, is it not? Aren't they intentionally creating and selling something that wasn't? And then, you know, and then we see that happen. You know, here, let me bring this up too.
Well, let me reply to that though, because I want to be very clear. It was organic in a sense that they were speaking about things that were actually taking place in their communities.
Okay.
But the manner in which they were speaking about it was as if they were the perpetuators of those things, and many of those things being negative, and that's where they donned the gangster blackface.
Right.
So what I'm saying is that organically, the message was reflective of some of the things that were taking place inside of the African American community. But for it to be weaponized, that was not something. I'm talking about the promotion of the gang culture in particular. For that to be weaponized, that wasn't strategically an attempt made by NWA per se.
Okay. Well, somebody above them could have said, aha, look what we can do with this as well. I mean, sometimes people might be willful idiots and not be aware that they're involved with it. But, one question that came up to me while watching your documentary was, you know, I wonder what the numbers of, say, the numbers of broken African-American families in the Los Angeles area and how much it's increased since NWA's albums first came out. Because if you look at it historically, in the 1940s, African-Americans had 7% roughly divorce rate, which was the lowest overall in the country. And then today, it's almost 93% divorce rate. So it's almost an exact flip. So, you know, there's probably a way to go in and see what the actual impact has been on the family and on the culture as a whole since that.
Yeah, well, I can say that, yes, it most definitely has had a negative effect. However, to say that there's a direct correlation, I think that would be a stretch. And this is simply to say that there are so many other outlining factors besides gangster rap or besides NWA. In point of fact, let's say it's quite possible that a significant percentage of those who are part of that divorce rate never even heard of NWA. So I think it's much more complex than that. But I want to get back to another issue, and I see your point, but I want to get back to another issue, and that is to say that NWA, in terms of the transformation that took place in their lyrics, because I also illustrate how throughout the course of the lyrics from the first album to their fourth album, that the negativity and the destructive nature of those lyrics, especially when it comes to the murder of African Americans in their lyrics, it actually increased over time. I would not say that was because it was a strategic effort on NWA's part to promote that per se for social engineering purposes. I would say that they did that simply because it was profitable.
Sure. But, you know, I suspect that somebody in the Hollywood, record studios and record companies knew something about, the impact that this was having. Because here's the thing, is we've looked at this in music, and we did basically a 20-hour series with Hans Utter, and we can actually see from going way back to Harry Smith and the promotion through folk music of the degradation of society into rock and roll, into punk music, into rap, into techno, a slow progression selling the degradation of family, of society, sort of a backward direction rather than a forward, betterment direction. So, we've seen this all throughout the music, not just in rap per se. You know, if we look at, you know, the white kids got, you know, Slayer and death metal, for instance, right? And you know, think about like Blue Oyster Cult, right? They have the songs, Don't Fear the Reaper. And this is a song actually, you know, talking about repetition and subliminal messages in songs. This is a song about, you know, encouraging children or young adults to commit suicide. And in fact, do it together. So, you know, it's not that everybody who heard the song went out and committed suicide, but how many did? You know, that's the real question. Or how many contemplated it because of the song? And so then, you know, we're looking at finer things, but it's a nuance that seems to be throughout the music industry. And the more we look at music and how, you know, as soon as you start nodding your head along to the beat, you're in a trance. You know, you're actually hypnotized, and then that's when they can, you know, get that subliminal message into your mind. You know, and it's like you somebody raised a point during your documentary that, you know, you can hear a song, and I think they used the Oscar Mayer Wiener song from like the 1980s. You only have to hear like three or four beats of a song usually to have instant recall of the full song, right? So, you know, that song with the music, that message is embedded in there, you know, and it's just whether or not I think the person is conscious enough to act on, to not act on it or to act on it.
Yes, yes. And then, of course, the degree to which they're exposed to it over time is also something that needs to be considered, because there are people who may initially have an aversion to certain genres of music, you know, or even certain messages in music. But if over time they're continuously exposed to it, they may actually accept some of the programming as being legitimate and worthwhile. And then there's another factor I just want us to consider too. And that is to say that many of us were raised on this type of thing. So, you know, as an example, the violence, the disrespect of women calling each other niggas and the bitches, and then for it to be in the music, and many of us, we were raised on that music. So there's another dynamic to this, and I think it's important for us to understand, especially parents to understand, is that children are very impressionable. And so as an adult, we may hear these songs, we may hear these lyrics, and we may say, no, it's not necessarily affecting me, but this doesn't mean that it's not going to have a serious effect on your child. So part of the message in the film was for parents to become aware of the types of critical thinking and critical analysis that will be necessary in order to protect your children's subconscious mind. So let me just say this too, that no doubt the lyrics have influence. That's really what the documentary is about, and also providing people with intellectual tools to calculate and analyze music lyrics so they can understand the impact, the potential impact. But that there's another dynamic to this, and that is to say that parents have to be aware of this so that they can put forth the effort to protect their children's subconscious mind from this type of mind control or programming.
You know, that brings up a really important point. I'm glad you said that, because you know, I started watching your documentary with my son. And about 23 minutes in, I had to turn it off. And my son looks at me and he says, you know, and the reason why I turned it off. And my son looks at me and he says, Dad, I don't think this is appropriate for me. So, you know, where do we, you know, because it's the children that need the message. And at the same time, how do we balance the children needing that message versus just breaking down and explaining what your documentary does, you know, can be, you know, too vulgar.
Yeah, well, the thing is this, that's where the parents have to be clear about where their child is at. In point of fact, I haven't let any of my children see the documentary, because we actually analyze lyrics and we look at the actual words that are being used, including words like niggas and bitches and fuck the police, so forth and so on. So it's important for parents to be clear about where their child is at in their own development. In point of fact, you know, there's also another thing, and this is to be real, culturally speaking, in some African-American communities, there are 10-year-olds that can listen to NWA's lyrics and they won't bat an eye, because they were actually raised on that language and they've been raised in that language. So they don't see it as anything significant. And therefore, when we talk about the use of the word bitch, when they hear the word bitch in the film, they won't necessarily find it to be troubling at all, because they've been raised on it. In your son's case, It's inappropriate for him. In my children's case, it's also inappropriate. So part of the strategy for me was to provide parents with the tools that they will need in order to protect their children's subconscious mind. And then based upon what they learn in the film, they can assess whether or not it's appropriate for their children to hear the analysis that we give in terms of particular lyrics in the film that we analyze. That's totally inappropriate, in my opinion, for children to listen to. But again, going back to when I was growing up as a child, this was not just music that, you know, we weren't analyzing it at all. We were actually listening to it, taking it in as at face value. Hopefully, this documentary will help parents to instruct their children so that they won't do such a thing.
Understood. Yeah, you know, I just sat down thinking, oh, this might be a good tool to teach my son. And then 23 minutes in, he's like looking at me and I'm like, yeah, I'll turn it off.
Yeah, age appropriate. You have to make sure that your child.
Yeah, I probably should have watched it first and then, yes. You know, and then decided. But yeah, so. All right. So let's get over to another topic. And then from here, I want to talk about the N-word. And then from here, I want to segue into this, you know, what's the term that you use in the documentary film? The so-called, you know, banter, the put downs.
Oh, the beefing and the playing the dozens. Yes.
Right. Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. So let's first talk about the use of the word nigger in society. How do you feel about the use of this word itself within the Black community, and then it being spread by music, hip hop, etc., and, you know, people using this word as if, you know, it's a good thing?
Yes. Well, just to keep in mind that the word was not proliferated simply by the music. In point of fact, the word was proliferated by racist white people. I'm talking about historically speaking. However, what tends to happen is that terminology that is being that has been used by oppressors in the past is oftentimes adopted by the descendants of the oppressed. It's interesting because there are people who have been oppressed by that word and they adopted it, they used it to disrespect each other, but then their children heard it, and their children's children then heard it, and their children's children's children heard it. And so therefore, at a certain point, it becomes part of
the vernacular.
The common vernacular within that group of people. But then what has happened in terms of the use of the word nigger, and I'm saying nigger, not nigger, there's a difference. What has happened?
What's the difference?
Yes. Well, ask me that in just a second.
All right.
What has happened culturally with the use of the word nigger is that in particular in gangster rap, but this is in you know, plenty of different other subgenres of hip hop or subgenres of rap music, that it was used so much and it was used in such a way to where it became popular. So now you get the popularization of it. So more people are exposed to it, more people are accepting it as part of their vernacular. And then now not only do you have African Americans or Black people calling each other niggas, but then you also have other groups of people calling each other niggas, and those other groups of people calling African Americans niggas too. I was on the and ask me that question just a moment. I was on the basketball court when I was in college. So 17, 18, 19, 20 years old. And we're playing basketball, and it was me and some of my homeboys. They were from Compton. And we were playing against some Asians. It was a large Asian population at University of California, Irvine. So we're playing against these Asians, and we're going back. We're playing ball and all this stuff, and we're having a good time. Everyone's having a good time. No problem, no beef. Okay, no beef. One of the Asian dudes was like, yeah, my nigga. And I was like, whoa, hold on. Wait a minute. What's going on here? What I'm saying is that what has happened with a lot of the music and the programming within the music and the proliferation through the music of the use of the word nigga. Okay? And again, this is in the aftermath of it being used as nigger by white people and really popularized by white people as a term, not of endearment, but as a term of disrespect. What has happened now to the music is that it has promoted the word as being somehow okay, as it being a term of endearment. Right. And so now other groups of people, they hear that and it's become popular, and they see the people on you know, in the rap music videos, or they see them in the movies or what have you, and they're cool, so they want to mimic that. And so now you have Asian people calling me a nigga on the basketball court.
Right. Well, you know, and, you know, that's interesting that you bring this point up, because, you know, we see the exact same thing with the term redneck, actually, and most people don't realize that redneck was a derogatory term used for white slaves.
Mm-hmm.
And so now this has become part of the vernacular, and white people call calling each other rednecks, you know, blacks, Asians calling each other rednecks, etc. Mm-hmm. And it was meant as a derogatory term for white slaves and indentured servants, you know.
And it's interesting because when I hear people call, it doesn't matter who it is, it can be a white person or a black person or any other person. When I hear them calling a white people rednecks, I know that it's not right. You know, it's not right.
It's like another one that you hear very commonly is honky. Right?
Yes. I used to use that one a lot. Yes, it's very true. I used to use that a lot when we would talk about white people. We would call them honkies. This is just being honest. You know, so that's what I mean. Like, the language, it has a historical precedence, but then there's a more modern day retooling of the language. But when we really look at the language, it's about disrespect. It's really about disrespect. And it's also about the devaluation of other human beings. And that's what I really have a problem about. If you call me a nigger, I wouldn't really trip. I don't really care. The other thing is that if someone wants to call me a nigger or a nigger for that matter, I don't take it personally. Now, you call my children that, I'm going to have a problem. But you call me that, I don't necessarily have a problem with it, because ignorance is ignorance. And if people want to be ignorant in their language, they can be ignorant in their language. That's not my fault. And I'm not responsible for the words that another person uses. But the point is that for it to be passed down as a legacy, especially within the African-American community, in terms of nigger being transformed into nigger, and then now nigger now somehow being okay. And here's the thing, we often say that we use it as a term of endearment, but the truth is, and I'll let you in on a little cultural secret within the African-American community, 90% of the time when we call people niggers, it's not in a positive way. It's not to express love or appreciation for them. 90%
so it's
of the
used
time,
derogatorily. It's,
that's
in,
right.
Wow. Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you want to talk about the difference between nigger and nigger?
Well, I mean, you kind of already explained it, but if you want to go into it further, go for it, you know.
Yeah, well, I think,
and you and I were talking during the week about race relations 101. I think it's
That's
an
true.
Important topic, you know. There's a whole field, a whole area of documentary making and research and everything that could be laid out here, you
That's
know.
That's true. Well, in 20 seconds or less, let me just say that traditionally the nigger is used in a derogatory way to disrespect African Americans and dehumanize African Americans or black people, used by white people. Whereas nigger is a more transformed, transmogrified, it is a more accepting, somehow inviting use of the derivative of nigger, but it's in many cases we try to play it off as if it is a term of endearment. When in point of fact, most of the time when we use it, I'm gonna tell on myself too, because I'm a very honest person. I don't use it, but I do. But it does come to, I'm talking about verbalizing. I think I did, the last time I did was about a year ago, about a year and a half ago with a friend of mine who was at my cousin's house. This is why we're working on it.
And it just slipped out,
yes,
what?
Yeah. But let me be clear that in my mind, it actually comes to mind quite a bit. And it just doesn't come to mind when I'm thinking about ignorant behavior by, let's say, a black person, but it can be ignorant behavior that I'm observing by anybody, a white person. And I'll say, look, that's some nigger shit right there. I'll say that in my mind. I don't verbalize it. And then I say, you know, I shouldn't be saying that. But this goes
That's to some ignorant shit right there.
Yeah, right. But this goes to show you that the programming, you know, I said something else, and I said that language, especially the word nigger, when we use it, it's like a virus, and it sticks with you for the rest of your life. Once you have it ingrained in your mind, it sticks with you for the rest of your life. Even if you go through the process of improving upon your vocabulary, you're trying to purify your language, and you're not trying to call women bitches anymore. You're not trying to call people niggas, and you're not trying to do any of that anymore. It still sticks with you, and from time to time, it still pops up. That's an aspect of the mind control aspect of the language that I was indoctrinated into, in part by NWA's proliferation of the use of the word nigga, which is different than the word nigger.
Right. You know, this all brings up another point. And it's like right there, and this probably falls underneath another show, but I want to bring it up anyway, a whole other topic, series, whatever. But, okay, so you have like Ebonics versus the Joneses, okay? Mm-hmm. And this to me, which you don't see, for instance, in the UK, seems an intentional method of dividing, like divide and conquer, you know, so that it creates a communication barrier.
Mm.
Anything to add to that?
Well, I can see that. What I would add, and this may be controversial, I can speak Ebonics quite well. In fact, you know, under normal circumstances, the manner in which I speak is probably closer to speaking in Ebonics compared to how I'm speaking with you here. But I think the challenge is, because it does have function in particular communities, the challenge is that it can put you in an extreme state of disadvantage on the world stage.
Right.
Because you may not necessarily have the capacity to communicate with other groups of people, and by not having the ability to
communicate effectively.
Yes, effectively with other people, and by not having the ability to communicate that effectively, it may actually stop you from having certain opportunities granted.
Right. Right.
So that's what I would say to that. It's important. I think that it has functionality. It's important. I can go into any hood and I can talk with folk and they'll know exactly what I'm talking about. They can talk about, I know exactly what they're talking about. We'll be using the language and the niggers and fuck you. We know all, but all, but I also recognize at a very early age that I had to expand my vocabulary because it would open up other opportunities for me too. So I think that that's important. It's important for black folk, African-American folk to be clear that, yeah, you can keep that certain aspects of that, but you also have to develop other aspects of your communication style, if you will, so that you can actually communicate with other groups of people effectively.
Now, something you mentioned at the beginning of the show was that, you know, niggas with attitude, or attitudes, just the name of the band itself had a shock value. Now, last week I had Gavin Kearney on the show again, and we had discussed, you know, he's been on the show previously, and we discussed the degradation of society through modern art and, you know, how modern art is essentially not about the art and creating something fine, a fine work of art itself. It's about the shock value and creating a reaction out of the audience. So you have, you know, women menstruating on canvases these days and calling it art and all of this sort of stuff. So, you know, back then, NWA apparently used this for the shock value.
Yeah, absolutely.
Rather than for the art content itself.
Yeah, it was never about art. In my opinion, it was never about art. See, that's the thing. When I did research into Eazy-E, he was very intelligent about capturing attention. See, just historically speaking, that's why I want people to understand that sometimes, you know, when you look at the ability to capture attention, that's really the ability to draw income. It's the ability to monetize. The more attention you can draw, I mean, there's people who have absolutely, I mean, no real talent, you know, in social media or, you know, but because they can gain attention, you know, they're millionaires. You know, and there's plenty of people who actually live that. They can look a certain type of way, and that's their gift, I guess. And they don't necessarily have anything profound to say, or they're not necessarily doing anything outside of looking a particular type of way. But because they look that way and they post certain types of pictures, what they're doing is they're drawing attention. They're shocking people, and it's drawing attention. The more attention they draw, you can monetize attention. So that's one of the things that Eazy-E was ingenious about. He recognized early on that if I can shock people, if I can say something that will cause people to go, oh, my goodness, that they may be repulsed by it, but because they're repulsed by it, they're going to give their attention to it. And that's precisely what NWA did. So why not? Out of anything that you can call, what out of all the names that you can choose, you're going to call yourself niggas with attitudes. Now, if you're younger and you're watching this video right now, let's say you're in your 20s or younger, you may not even find that to be significant. You're like, oh, that's no big deal. It's just niggas, right?
Yeah, listen to these old guys like complaining. What's their problem? They ain't hip, man.
But I want y'all to put this in a historical context. Back in the mid to late 80s, going into the 90s, it was still considered to be highly controversial. But again, and I think you were kind of alluding to this earlier, how this works and how the mind control works and the social engineering aspects works is over time. You can move a whole society wherein, let's say 20 years ago, they would be repulsed by having a group being called niggas with attitudes. But over time, you can condition them to accept that, and it becomes cool and popular. And then now here we are all these years later, not only do people say, oh, that's no big deal that they call themselves niggas with attitudes, I'm not shocked, but now those same people call each other niggas and don't even think twice about it. But that's only because of the social engineering aspect and the type of impact that groups like NWA had in terms of the vernacular and the language that we were being.
The Harvard Social Relations Department and SRI are sitting there watching this, clapping and overjoyed with themselves at how successful they were. F you guys.
Okay. Yes.
We've done a lot on those groups, a lot of research showing how they're intentionally engineering this stuff. And, you know, I don't know how much of my research. Did you see any of my series, Music, Mind Control, Psychobiology?
Yes, I did.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, because and earlier in the show, you talked about creating the different genres and all of this. All of these things are different strategies of divide and conquer, because you walk into any high school campus in the country and the kids automatically segregate themselves by the type of music that they listen to.
This is true.
You know, and then not only that, if you listen to the music by decade, and you can go on like satellite radio, it's really easy to do it there. And they used to have a 40s channel. I think they got rid of it recently, but every 10 years, right on the decade line, there's a significant split in the type of music. Like when I was graduating high school in 1990, out came this terrible stuff from Seattle called Nirvana. And all of the seniors were like, what the hell is this crap?
Okay.
You know, that all of the juniors and sophomores are into, right? But but every 10 years, they create. There's a shift in the type of music, which actually creates a division from parents to children as well.
Yes. I was thinking about that the other day, and that's one of the dynamics that I saw with NWA's influence, because there was a whole shift in language and what was acceptable in terms of language. Also, what was acceptable in terms of how we spoke about women, you know, calling them bitches and hoes and skanks and skeezers. You see how the language, it rolls right off of my tongue. Yeah, it's interesting because it's true. This goes to show. And it's not just NWA. I want us to be clear. It's not just NWA. It's just the whole cultural phenomenon within the African-American community and how over time. See, this is what I mean. This is what I'm going to get to, because you bring up such a very important point, because it's not just about dividing us based upon social quote-unquote class or economic class or based upon quote-unquote race. It's not just about that. It's also about dividing father from son and father from daughter and mother from son and mother from daughter. And what I mean by that is that in the African-American community in particular, and I don't know if this is the case for other communities, but there is such a lack of cultural cohesion. And what I mean by that is even within the language that we use, every single generation has a new vernacular.
Absolutely. Yep. Exactly so. So you aren't hip, you aren't this, and it creates that artificial divide, just like the rappers from the heavy metalers, from the death metalers, from the trance music, from the Burning Man, from the country, you know, from the new wave, new whatever type of music. Each one of those creates false divide between the kids themselves and then generationally as well.
That's right. And I wanted to add, because this is something, another point you brought up earlier that I just wanted to reiterate, that the division is not just cross-generational, but it
I'm blocking some idiot who's got a problem with you.
Oh, that's okay. You can tell him or her that I love them. What I was going to say was that part of the divide is also about the language that we use and how we're able to communicate. So, for example, as we were talking earlier, how there's a need for those of us who speak Ebonics, or what is called Ebonics. There's a need for us to also develop our vocabulary beyond that so that we can actually communicate effectively with other groups of people. Well, just imagine if with each generation, we have a whole new language coming in onto the scene. And so now the new generation has a very difficult time communicating effectively with the previous generation. And then that previous generation has a very difficult time communicating effectively with the previous generation. So therefore, our ability to communicate cross-generationally becomes disrupted. And the problem with that is that there is a lot of wisdom that the newer generation can gain from the previous generation, that the newer generation can gain from the generations two generations past. But a lot of that, the transference of that wisdom is not being passed on, because especially in the African-American community, there's a serious lack of cultural cohesion, which also includes the language that we use.
Interesting.
Can I give you a quick example, by the way?
Yeah, go for it.
My father used to say, "I'm hip." Do you know what that means?
Yeah, well, I used to have a black friend. She died about 15 years ago, but she used to say this all the time. So.
Okay. A lot of younger African-American folk, they won't know what that means. "I'm hip" means, it's basically like saying, "I'm hip." In other words, I understand. I know what you're talking about. But see, when my father was sitting, I'd be like, what is he saying? It doesn't make any sense. Now, for us to say I'm hip, we would say something like, I'm down with that.
Well, yeah. So get this. Even I'm hip is a derogatory term, because guess where that comes from? Hippie and hipster.
Okay.
And the hipsters, the hippies originally, were people who laid on their hips on a pillow in the opium den smoking a pipe.
I did not know that.
Yeah. So, I mean, see how they push it all the way down and through, right?
Very interesting. But you see that the language, the lack of cultural cohesion. And see, so part of what I'm saying here is with my sons, how I speak to them is how I'm kind of speaking to you here, right? And so, therefore, the manner in which we communicate is pretty much, this is kind of like the standard. So there's going to be information I'm going to be able to transmit to my sons that they wouldn't necessarily, they wouldn't get if they have a whole new vernacular. And see, they're not listening to others, the types of music that they're listening, we're very careful about that. They're not listening to NWA. I haven't let them see my documentary. I don't even want them to know what NWA. In fact, let me tell you something. This is very interesting. My children, including my six-year-old, when they hear they may not even hear what lyrics are being said, but if someone is rapping and they hear a certain type of a beat, they're automatically stopped and they'll say, "Dad, is this inappropriate?" And the reason why is because over the years they've heard enough of rap music and have heard enough of the dysfunctional language and disrespectful language, and they, in their mind, they already recognize that there's something wrong. So anytime they hear the beat, they automatically pause and stop and they say, "Now, is this inappropriate?"
Yeah. Well, to my son's credit, last year, after I had done the series with Dr. Hans Utter on music, mind control, and psychobiology, one day, after maybe episode 4 or 5, my son brings me his entire CD collection, and he's been hearing me edit the series and everything. He says,
"Okay,
Dad, I don't want this stuff anymore," and he gives it to me. And pretty much, the only thing that's age appropriate for a 9, 10, 11-year-old these days, at least, that he was into, is something like Weird Al Yankovic, I mean, he's probably one of the most PC people. He's got a couple songs that are like, all right, you need to change that one, but teaching people, kids about grammar and stuff and making fun of the whole rest of the music scene isn't as bad as, a lot of, I think he took the higher road, it seems,
But I wanted to say that it's definitely a good thing that your son can see the dysfunction in what he's hearing and that he's willing to let it go at such an early age. Because see, a lot of us, we didn't let it go. And in fact, there are a lot of us who still hold on to some of the principles that we were indoctrinated into, including disrespecting women.
Well, and here's the thing, is you get into this music, this type of stuff, usually in your junior high to high school years.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And then you're into whatever kind of music you choose or your favorite band or whatever, and it pretty much sticks with you into your, 40s, 50s, 60s, whatever. But, at what point do you wake up and realize, the Grateful Dead selling sex, drugs, and rock and roll for the CIA for 50 years, maybe that wasn't so cool. Maybe Bob Weir hanging out with General Bill McQuinn and hanging out at Bohemian Grove and cracking jokes about how they're all doing experiments for the company, maybe that stuff's not so cool after all. Maybe we should just, let it go. Let go of this false, hero worship. What they do is they peacock someone and put them in front of everybody, and then everybody chases after the peacock. It's standard, they're manipulating the natural will of the herd to follow an alpha. And, by putting people up on stage, whether it's Brad Pitt or, NWA, whatever it is, they put these people out in front of us, Dr. Dre, Jay-Z. Jay-Z's probably, in my opinion, one of the worst out there today. And it looks like he's, running this Monarch stuff at the same time on Beyonce and this other stuff going on. But, it's just, at some point you got to take a step back and look at the whole thing and say, you know what, maybe I need to learn to be my own hero and the best I can be. And, maybe I can one day hope to live up to the person my wife or girlfriend or whomever it is thinks I am, fake it till you make it or whatever. But I'm going to try and strive to be a better person every day and forget the stupid hero worship.
Yeah, I think that that's an important dynamic. And let me just add that in the African American community, I think that that's a major issue, that the hero worship, because so many of us, we grew up without fathers. So there are a lot of young African American males, when I was growing up, they looked to the hip hop artists as their surrogate father. So you can imagine, therefore, that even when they're 40, by the time they're 40 or even 50 nowadays, that and they listen to these hip hop artists, that it's very difficult for them to admit that what they perceive to be their own father, that their own father, symbolically speaking, didn't necessarily have a positive message. Now, the other thing is that in our youth, without the proper intellectual process, there's a lot of things that we accepted and we thought that it was in our best interest. That's where the documentary comes in. Like, really ask a critical question. Parents in particular ask the question, is this in my child's best interest? Most of our children, there are a few exceptions, they do not have the intellectual aptitude to be able to ascertain or determine whether or not what they're listening to is in their best interest. So what happens is that if they're raised on it, if the parents don't have a conversation about the quality of the lyrics that they're listening to or the quality of the music they're listening to, they'll grow up and from a young child, they'll see that particular artist as a hero. They'll perceive that particular artist in some cases as their father figure, the father that wasn't there. And so therefore, when they become 40, when they become 30, when they become 40, when they become 50, even when they know that the lyrics weren't in their best interest, they still hold on to the hero. What's the word? Cognitive dissonance. Right?
Absolutely. It's almost like Stockholm syndrome as well.
Yes, this is true.
Well, let me throw you one, okay? So let's say Jim Morrison and the Doors, right? Out of Laurel Canyon, which, of course, big CIA center there, and Jim Morrison's father was Admiral Morrison, the same Admiral Morrison who did the Gulf of Tonkin that got us into the Vietnam War. And then Jim Morrison becomes the poster boy for this, and then he's on stage. I mean, the whole thing is manufactured. You know, you read Dave McGowan's work.
Mark Devlin.
Yep. And, you know, Weird Scenes in the Canyon. We've covered this stuff extensively. But, you know, so Jim Morrison, he becomes the poster boy of this stuff. And then he's on stage singing about the Oedipus complex and how he wants to do his mother.
No response. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you can see that they didn't just target, you know, my point is that they targeted everybody.
No, this is true. You know, this is true. Someone brought up, too, something else, because I think this was at my lecture at the Free Your Mind conference. I think this was afterwards. Someone had brought up, yes, that gangster rap strategically targeted the African-American community, but it also had a major impact on other groups of people. In point of fact, the people who purchased N.W.A.'s albums the most, it was not black folk, it was white folk. Let's be clear about that. But someone had mentioned that these types of program, this negative programming that's out there, and in point of fact, the programming that is promoted by the entertainment industries, that it's not quote unquote race specific. In other words, that they have programs for other groups of people too. And one of the people there that were older, they said, you know, even, what was it? The flower power and the, what did they call it? The hippie era with the psychedelics and all that. So that too was a form of social engineering. And that,
oh,
too,
well, I've done the last 5 years. That's my area of expertise, is how the entire hippie culture and the counterculture of the 60s was manufactured to control and dumb people down. I mean, that's my prime area of research, you know?
Okay. Well, maybe the person that I talked to, maybe they saw your work. But I hadn't thought about that because, you know, we kind of live in our own little bubbles. But when they referred to that, it really put things in perspective for me that, yes, social engineering is not race specific. In other words,
they'll target different groups with different types of social engineering, but the overall program is the same.
Yes. Yes.
You know, like the black community gets hip hop, the white community gets the Grateful Dead and the Doors and, you know, some other crap, Slayer, whatever, you name it, you know, and, you know, and, but meanwhile, what's the message? Sex, drugs, rock and roll. The other one's sex, drugs and hip hop, right?
Yes.
And violence.
Yes.
Sorry to interrupt you. You know, we only have a couple of minutes left here.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. Okay.
Yeah. Did you have anything you want to toss in? It looks like we've got about... minute and a half left.
Well, there were some things, but that's okay. What I would like to do, if you don't mind, is just give the information out to people if they want to go and check.
Well, sure. You know, if you want a few extra minutes here, go ahead and hit any main points you want. I'll shut up for a few minutes, and then we'll just wrap it up a couple minutes late.
Okay. I just want to add here, and this will be the only thing, just to understand that the the impact of repetition. And when you really get deep into the critical analysis and start to really crunch numbers, and that's what I did, like I really crunched some numbers, you begin to see some very, very startling things. And one of the things that I did in the documentary was I began to break down not just the word counts, but the frequency at which certain themes were being presented. So averages, per minute averages. And I just want to share something with you all here. And we talk about the disrespect of women, because disrespect of women was the preeminent theme present in NWA's lyrics. There were also 177 instances of disrespect towards women, including calling women derogatory names, physical violence against women, sexual abuse of women, sexism against women, et cetera. To put these statistics in perspective, if you listen to NWA's first album, this is just on the first album, 177 instances of disrespect towards women. You would hear the endorsement of alcohol once every 51 seconds. You would hear the disrespect of men once every 49 seconds. The word bitch once every 46 seconds. Self-aggrandizement once every 34 seconds. And the disrespect of women once every 17 seconds. So what this shows is that even if you look at per minute averages and you're a young impressionable child and you're listening to NWA's first album, I have it broken down in terms of first album, second, third, and fourth album, and then all albums combined. But just on the first album, if you listen to that first album, you would hear the disrespect of women once every 17 seconds. Now, as a young impressionable child, what impact does that have?
And that's, keep in mind, folks, your average child, your average young adult isn't going to listen to that song just one time. They're going to play it over and over and over until they're completely sick of it. And then for the next 5, 10, 15 years after that, every time they go to a nightclub or whatever, they're going to hear it, and it's going to be, you know, reinforced later on in life as well.
Yes. If you don't mind, we also talked about their song Fuck the Police, and that's where the F-bomb was being dropped in the film. I just want to add this too, because one of the misconceptions that people have and had about NWA was that somehow they were socially conscious. How can you be socially conscious when the preeminent theme in your music is the disrespect of women? In point of fact, they disrespected women on their four albums a total of 334 times. How can that be socially conscious? And when I saw the film, one of the things that they tried to do was they tried to play on police brutality, which is a real phenomenon, but they tried to play on that current phenomenon being kind of like a hot button topic, and they try to present NWA as if they were somehow socially conscious and as if they were the ones speaking out against police brutality. But I wanted, when we get into the critical analysis, I want people to understand something that I found that was very, very critical to the documentary. On NWA's second album, the phrase "fuck the police" was stated, and this would be the last thing, a total of 21 times. On the same album, NWA members committed violence against African-American males a total of 32 times. So you're talking about fuck the police 21 times, but then you're actually committing violence against your own people 32 times. Police officers committed violence against African-Americans one time. NWA members committed violence against African-American females a total of 14 times. Police officers committed violence against African-American females zero times. The irony is that while NWA criticized police for abusing African-Americans, NWA was also the main perpetrators of abuse against African-Americans in their lyrics. The critical question that we can ask is it hypocritical for NWA to use their lyrics to criticize abuse of police officers while simultaneously using their lyrics to disrespect, abuse, and murder African-Americans? Get this. On their second album, the ratio of NWA abuse of African-Americans to police abuse of African-Americans is 46-1. So what that means is that for every one time that a police officer abuses an African-American, NWA actually physically abuses or commits violence against African-Americans 46 times. And the last point, to put these statistics into perspective, if you listen to NWA's second album, you would hear NWA members committing violence against African-American females about once every 4 minutes. You would hear NWA members committing violence against African-American males about once every 2 minutes. References to guns, gangs, and drugs about once every 2 minutes, respectively. The word nigga about once every 90 seconds. Disrespect of men once every 58 seconds. And disrespect of women once every 43 seconds. This is the power of critical analysis. And if you just listen to their lyrics with a critical eye and a critical ear, the truth will be revealed in terms of the quality and character of their lyrical composition.
All right, Lennon, what are your websites? How can people find your new documentary, Beyond Gangsta Blackface?
Yeah, so if you want to watch the online stream of the documentary, you can go to beyondgangsterblackface.vhx.tv. Okay, beyondgangsterblackface.vhx.tv. We also have a DVD version, which is the extended version. I think you get an extra hour and 20 something minutes worth of video content. You can purchase your DVD at www.beyondgangsterblackface.com. That's www.beyondgangsterblackface.com.
And your main website is linenhonor.com. Do you want to give out your email address if people want to reach you?
Yeah, sure. If you want to reach me, my email is linenhonor@yahoo.com. LENONHONOR@yahoo.com. And I'm also on Facebook. I got a lot of content up on Facebook. I'm on Facebook, but I'm also on YouTube. I have a lot of YouTube videos up, and my YouTube page is Linen Honor Films.
Great. And ladies and gentlemen, make sure you support Linen. Make sure you get a copy of his video or check it out online. I've watched it twice. Good stuff. Also support the show. Go to GnosticMedia.com. Donation button is right at the top. We'll see you hopefully next week. I'm not sure who we'll have back, but enjoy. Until next time, good night.